on arrival by Quiche officials and are valid for up to 14 days.
With its mesmerizing nature and eye-catching urban landscapes, Quiche has earned the title of the Bride of the Persian Gulf. Its authorities say the island is already a hub for Iranian travelers, but they say they seek to turn it into a regional tourist magnet. Yusuf Jalalip from Quiche Island.
On Saturday, 45-year-old Giorgia Meloni took an oath as Italy's prime minister before President Sergio Mattarella. Meloni, the country's first woman to become premier, is one of the founders and the current leader of the far-right-leaning party Brothers of Italy, the political force that spearheaded a right-wing coalition to victory in last month's general election. Besides bringing some political stability to Italy, which has seen 68 governments in its 74 years of history as a republic, Meloni will have to face a series of daunting challenges, including a looming recession, protecting Italians from surging energy bills, and reassuring the establishment about her Atlanticist and anti-Putin alignment.
Delegates from our coalition met with President Mattarella, and they agreed over the fact that there are many emergencies at national and international level, and quick answers are needed.
Italy's new Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, says her government will follow the line of NATO and the Western Alliance. Also, the new Foreign Minister, former European Parliament President Antonio Tajani, has repeatedly said he will be fully supportive of Kiev. Meloni's two main allies, media magnate Silvio Berlusconi and Matteo Salvini, are longtime admirers of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Earlier this week, a video portraying Berlusconi saying that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky should be held accountable for the conflict in Ukraine caused a stir in the political arena. Italians are hoping the new government will work for a peaceful resolution to the conflict in Ukraine.
We must do all we can to stop the war through negotiations and dialogue, and the new government must help Italians to pay energy bills. We are on our knees.
We are confident that the new government will do good. Its biggest challenge will be easing the impact of soaring energy bills on Italians.
Meloni is expected to lay out her political priorities next week when she faces confidence votes at the parliament that will confirm or not that she holds a majority. Max Civili, Rome.
A refugee camp somewhere in the Luhansk region of Donbass. The civilians here are Russian speakers who fled recent Ukrainian advances not far to the west.
Now, the people here won't speak to me on camera. They are simply too scared. I've also been told not to give the exact location of this site or even the town that we're in fear that the Ukrainians might target the center with artillery strikes.
This woman, sobbing into her hands, tells me she has family in Ukrainian territory. They also tell me that they are scared to be put on Telegram channels like this, called Collaborators of Luhansk. It posts the photos and details of anyone accused of working with the Russians. It includes teachers and nurses. Along the battle lines, pro-Ukrainians generally flee west. Pro-Russians flee east. The ethnic boundaries of this once mixed country are being defined more clearly.
While this is a proxy war between Russia and NATO, it is also, at its root, a civil war between Ukrainian nationalists and its Russian-speaking minority, who are mainly situated in the east and the south of the country. The fact of the matter is, there is a strong likelihood, even a probability, that if Ukraine was to ever take back these four regions, there would be ethnic cleansing of the Russian-speaking population. The people here in Donbass say that this attempted ethnic cleansing by the Ukrainian army has been going on for the last 8 years.
While Russia and NATO continue to pursue their objectives on the battlefield, there is increasingly a peace to be made and new borders drawn if the views of the people living here were listened to. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
People from all walks of life rallied in the Gaza Strip following the Friday prayer in solidarity with Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. Protesters shouted slogans decrying the Israeli crimes in Al-Quds and in the occupied West Bank. In recent days, extremist Jewish settlers, backed by Israeli forces, have been violating the sanctity of Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. Israeli attacks usually increase during Jewish holidays. the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, which organized the rally, warned the Tel Aviv regime against crossing the red lines at Al-Aqsa Mosque compound.
Armed resistance is the only choice for Palestinians to fight the occupation. The Zionist enemy is playing with fire by attacking Al-Aqsa Mosque. The Palestinian resistance in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds is growing stronger. The Zionists are adding fuel to the fire, and it may only burn them.
Protesters in the Gaza Strip vowed to step up their support for Al-Quds until the end of all the Israeli violations in the Holy City. They also reiterated their adherence to resistance as the best way to defend Al-Quds.
We call on all Muslims to defend Al-Aqsa Mosque because it belongs to all Muslims. We call on our brothers and sisters in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds to increase armed resistance against the Zionist enemy. The whole world must understand that we are willing to sacrifice our lives for the sake of the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Al-Aqsa Mosque is Islam's third holiest site and has been under Israeli occupation since 1967, while Palestinians consider Al-Quds as the capital of their future state.
We are here today to condemn the continued Israeli attacks against our people in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. The Palestinians are fighting for a just cause, and they will continue to fight until they regain their freedom.
Palestinians maintain that continued Israeli infringements upon Al-Aqsa Mosque will only increase the resistance against the occupation.
Observers say the international community has failed to help Palestinians in Al-Quds while turning a blind eye to Israeli violations against them for decades. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
It's been just a few weeks since the now resigned Prime Minister, Liz Truss, promised low taxes and high growth. Events have moved incredibly fast in Westminster, that a new finance minister is now raising taxes and promising public sector cuts. The U-turns and counter-U-turns have come with a cost for the economy and the people. A new study has found that millions of households are skipping meals or struggling to put healthy foods on the table. Inflation is already at more than 10%. Energy and fuel prices are on the rise, putting a squeeze on Britain's finances.
Well, the start of all this is Brexit. Brexit led to Boris and incompetence. It led to falling living standards. It led to Liz Truss and further incompetence. And Britain basically voted to become poorer by leaving the EU. You can blame some of it on money printing at the Bank of England, inflation taking out, you know, and lowering living standards as well. So it's a combination of things.
A combination of things that have toppled two prime ministers in the span of 1 year.
It's been less than 2 months since Boris Johnson gave way to Liz Truss as prime minister, followed by the death of the Queen and a dramatic change in the country's economic outlook. And now, yet another leadership contest that could trigger even more economic and political instability.
And more instability means more people relying on charities, from food banks to keep their stomachs full, and warm rooms where those unable to heat their homes can take refuge in the cold months of winter. The new chancellor has curbed Liz Truss's flagship economic plan of a 2-year cap on energy bills to April next year. And at the end of this month, he's expected to announce a midterm economic policy that could spell out the beginning of another prolonged period of austerity.
Whoever takes over, Boris, Rishi, Mordaunt, who knows? But the outlook continues to be bad because inflation is still out of control. There's not the money or the government finances to give the public sector further wage rises to match that inflation. Strikes will continue. The fiscal position of the country remains dire, partly because we have a smaller economy because of Brexit. So there's no easy solution. There's no easy way out of this. The hole has been dug, and it's very deep and very difficult to climb out of.
Paying the price of that, ordinary Britons, as the Conservative Party races to choose its third leader and prime minister in 1 year, urgent help to those in need couldn't come any sooner. Saeed Purizza, London.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee, so recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makes me secure in the places of fear through thy security, and placest me in thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household, and make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The UK has another new Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak. He has said that he was not daunted by the scale of the economic challenge, pledging to lead the country through an economic crisis and to rebuild trust in politics. Well, that makes one wonder whether Sunak is really aware of the scale of the economic crisis that the UK is in, from inflation to the cost of living crisis to the political infighting and radical changes in policy that have horrified investors, alarming international allies. Sunak has his hands full. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether Sunak has the solutions needed to bring the UK out of this economic and political mess.
During his first speech as British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak used the occasion to issue a call for unity. Sunak must find a way to quickly unite not just a bitterly divided Conservative Party, but also a deeply troubled nation. However, he also issued warnings of difficult times ahead.
I will place economic stability and confidence at the heart of this government's agenda. This will mean difficult decisions to come.
The Prime Minister has inherited a country in crisis. Energy prices are high, cost of living through the roof, and millions of Brits are expected to struggle this winter. Another worry for Sunak, Conservative Party popularity has plummeted in recent months, sitting approximately 30 points behind the opposition Labour Party. Sunak's supporters say he's economically experienced from his days as Chancellor and praised Sunak as Britain's youngest leader in 200 years and the first ever non-white leader. But his critics claim that's just not enough.
He definitely has the credentials. He definitely has the experience, been there in the as Chancellor before. But again, we need to understand, you know, where does he sit right here, right now, with everyday voters? He has not been elected by the people, as well as most people feel that he cannot resonate with the ones that are struggling. I'm not sure if it is real representation for anyone of a minority background, especially when he comes from a very, very elitist club, and he does not really represent many. He's probably top 1% of majority of brown people or Asians, whatever you want to call it, in the entire world. So it's very difficult to sort of resonate and feel sort of close in that way.
Many challenges lie ahead for the new Prime Minister, in particular how he's going to overcome Britain's many economic crises. However, even if he does find a way to overcome Britain's economic woes, question marks still remain surrounding if he has what it takes to win the Conservatives the next general election. Robert Carter, London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right, we're going to go with our guests. Let me introduce them for this program. Limpet Opec, former member of the British Parliament, joins us from London. Also joining us is Shebri Rizvi, political analyst, who also joins us from London. Welcome to you both. I'll start with you, Limpet Opec, taking a look at the soap opera there in the UK with Rishi Sunak, a 42-year-old former hedge fund boss. I picked these out, see what you think. Only been in politics for 7 years, and estimated fortune, £730 million, or $830 million. And that is pointing to what many are feeling, that he may not be able to connect with Brits who are feeling inflation or who are in poverty. Obviously, a public that's strained by things that are that have put them into the crisis that they're in right now. Is that accurate?
We shall find out. But you've accurately raised his potential Achilles heel. Let's be honest, for a man who is worth over £700 million, a small increase to him of a couple of £1,000 in energy bills isn't going to be very important. He could almost be regarded as a hobby politician because he isn't going to suffer if the economy does. And so that's the biggest single question. Can he understand what millions of people in the UK are now suffering in terms of finances? The second one is, can he fix it? Liz Truss, in her 44 days in office, managed to trash the British economy. It was already in trouble, partly because of some idiotic energy policies, but she wrecked it. My estimate is that she has cost mortgage payers in the United Kingdom £80,000 million a year in extra interest rates. I'm one of those people. So can Rishi Sunak really wind back to the clock to a time where we had much more favourable interest rates, and that for a lot of people, paying an extra £8,000 or £10,000 a year is going to make them essentially poor? And then the third and the last point, is he clubbable? By that I mean, can he do what Boris Johnson did very well, which was appeal to individuals who wouldn't normally vote Conservative, but they did this time, and they gave Boris Johnson a big majority. Now, those are three big challenges. Of course, I'm not saying Labour Party could do any better, but they could win by default. If you get, if he doesn't do three out of three of the things I listed there, then two out of three isn't good enough. And that means he could lose the general election. That's what he's going to be judged on by his own party.
Taking a look at his economic agenda there, Shebri Rizvi, what is it? Do you know? Do we know? I mean, at this point, it may be too early to tell.
Hello, good evening. I don't think it's too late, because obviously the Sunak scenario is exactly the same as what the Conservative Party has been practicing for the last 12 years. We are told that it's going to be a difficult time. We have to take bold decisions. At the same time, he needs to fix the economy. What are these bold decisions? Does that mean that further cutting of the healthcare, further cutting of the schools sort of funding, further cutting on other social services in the United Kingdom? So if that's what he means by bold decisions, what I would say the bold decisions would be is to, you know, cap the bonuses of the bankers in London. It would be to increase perhaps the taxation to the highest earners, the 1%, his own cabal, who is in the category of millionaires, should they be paying more? Perhaps a bold decision would be to have a windfall tax on the energy providers. A bold decision on the economy would be to, bring parity for the lower paid earners, i.e., for example, just take one instance, a nurse. At the beginning, 12 years ago, when the Conservative Party came into power, is £4,000 less well off than she was 12 years ago. So bold decision would be to bring equal parity to the key workers, nurses, the policemen, the teachers, the care workers. I can go on. Multiple other sort of employees who have really lost out, not just on pay increases not taking place, but due to the inflation, they're actually a lot poorer than they were even 12 years ago. So bold decision. So as I said, the Sunak scenario doesn't sound any different than what has been practiced for the last 12 years. Yes, of course, the previous prime minister we've had, as you know, three prime ministers in 3 months. Hers was really an experiment to see whether ideological, fundamentalist, right-wing economic policies should be applied to the United Kingdom. And we saw what happened. Perhaps Mr. Sunak being more clever than Truss would actually do it more gently, but the end result would be more austerity, poor becoming poorer, and really the belt tightening would be required of the 99%, whilst the 1% really go to the bank all the way laughing.
When you have 17% of an increase in things like food, for example, Lempidopec, and of course we can talk about the inflation into other sectors, in particular at the top of the list practically would be the energy sector and gas bills. He's got to do something about those two. But the fact that our guest, Shabir Rizvi, talks about income, how it's fallen behind, obviously, was behind. Inflation obviously put that in fifth gear in terms of it falling behind even more. There's got to be an impact soon. But that could only be done if you're generating income. Not to get too technical about this, but generating income would then come in through the form of projections in one sense. But in this atmosphere of a war and lack of energy and what we're looking at, which is a recession, which many say the UK is not in one, but it is in a recession, how can he bring in results quickly, which is the key here?
We are in a recession in any meaningful way. The average citizen, not the millionaires, but the average citizen is feeling a lot poorer. And you've mentioned the three big things here: mortgages, fuel costs, and food costs. Those three are crippling anyone who was just about managing a few months ago. And turning to your question and continuing the debate, it's very hard to see what Rishi Sunak can do quickly without either borrowing even more, and he has borrowed more than any chancellor in the history of Britain, certainly since World War II, or making the kind of cuts that my colleague has just listed. Both of those are very difficult. It's probably easier for him to borrow, but then, of course, the world has just marked down the credibility of British politics and British government because it borrowed so much, at least it was going to under Liz Truss. So what is he to do? He can hope for a miracle. It's not going to come. He can ditch the energy policies, which are based heavily on environmental policies now. Wherever you stand on whether there's a climate crisis or not, Britain can't afford to do this right now. He should ditch net zero, and he should use fracking and domestic oil production to quickly reduce fuel prices. In terms of food prices, they'll then come down a little bit, just because energy is so important. Fuel is such a high percentage of most of the costs in the United Kingdom. But the big one is actually the mortgage situation. If you have a £200,000 mortgage, you're paying £8,000 a year extra every year. That dwarfs the increase in energy costs. What can he do about that? The only thing he can do is get interest rates down. Two ways to do that. One is to convince the Bank of England it can do that. And that's difficult when you've got 10% inflation. Or he could renationalize the Bank of England. That's the radical thing he could do. He could own interest rates, as occurred for decades, for pretty much a century in the UK, before a gesture of virtue signaling, the Labour Party said, no, you go off and set the interest rates independently. But as you can see from that list, it's a really difficult thing for Rishi Sunak to deliver. And probably it's going to get worse rather than get better. He's going to have a winter of discontent.
We need to understand, Shabir Rizvi, if you can, with the short amount of time that we have, as to what and why, I should say, the UK is in the position that it is in terms of its economy, which is cited to be one of the worst of the G7 countries, not just because of the pandemic, but prior to that, and maybe even some saying as far back as the 2007-08 financial crisis when it hit, maybe the UK was not able to truly recover, and it was just dragging itself along with GDP increases that were not that noteworthy. Are we looking at that far back when it comes to the UK economy dragging its feet and not doing well? And then, of course, then you got COVID and then you got the Ukraine conflict, and here we are.
Well, indeed, one has to look back over the last 12 years, and I have quite often pointed this out in our conversations on this matter, is that the financial crisis that hit the world in 2008, and of course it hit USA, the European Union, then we had what is called quantitative easing, literally government buying their own security, printing of money, all kinds of things. But then we had a Conservative Party came into power soon after in 2010. And they practiced really an ideologically based economic policy of austerity. This is what the IMF sort of prescribes to developing world wherever there's economic issues. They say that, you know, have austerity, sort of increase this, do less social welfare issues that impact the majority of the public. That kind of formula was applied not at the behest of the IMF, but really the government, which was ideologically based and wanting to really continue the practice of very sort of monetarist approach to the British economy. And here we have 12 years later, yes, you know, the mantra in the UK is even when the former Prime Minister Truss was leaving, she said Putin. But really, look, you know, the war in Ukraine may have some impact here. And the reality is that we are sort of burning money by supplying armaments to the Ukrainians. That will, of course, have an impact on the UK. Yes, we have sort of sanctioned Russia. Therefore, the oil and gas are not coming on the market, hence increasing the energy price. But the reality is that the Conservative Party needs to abandon its ideologically based economic policies. They really don't have much left in the fiscal armory to do. Yes, we've got the Chancellor who's going to be announcing his budget on 31st of October, an ominous day, Halloween, you know, which is the sign of sort of coming out of summer into the dark days of winter. Perhaps Britain is moving into the dark days of winter, whilst we haven't had a very bright summer either.
Well, to use your words, dark days of winter is what I think we're looking at, Lempidopic, if you agree, where there has been predictions made by, I think, the UK electric power grid, that there may be three-hour outages in electricity. So let's take a little bit of a break, Lempidopic, if we can, from the economic aspects of Rishi Sunak and the challenges he faces there, and how he needs to get his party together. Based on the report that we just saw by Rob Carter, the Conservative Party's popularity is really lagging behind the Labour, and it has dropped quite dramatically. And there's, of course, talks of infighting within the party. How much of a challenge does that pose for Sunak, even though he is picking, I guess, new cabinet members, and a reshuffle is on the way from what we understand?
It's in process now. You mentioned the pending power cuts, which Rishi Sunak himself warned would happen. Well, the lights are going off on the popularity of the Conservative Party, and you could say that Liz Truss was massively instrumental in putting the Conservative Party 30 percentage points behind Labour. It's not because I think that Keir Starmer's doing a particularly good job. I think he's a rather poor opposition leader. But by default, the Conservatives are so unpopular that people go to Labour thinking, well, anyone but the Conservatives. And Boris Johnson didn't help either. What can he do is the question you asked me. What he can do is a good job of the economy. He can stop those power cuts, because if the power cuts come, everyone will remember, at least people of my age will remember, the winter of discontent, as it was called in 1978 and 1979, a line which Margaret Thatcher, a Tory opposition leader, went on to be prime minister, used against Labour. Well, they'll get that thrown right back in their face. Internally, he also has problems, because some people still blame Rishi Sunak for the demise of Boris Johnson's premiership. And because there wasn't an election, let's remember, Rishi Sunak was not elected prime minister. He was appointed by minister by default. That means there's that discontent in the party too. Can he pull it back? Not without some luck. He needs to be lucky that there aren't power cuts, because that will really put the lights out on popularity of the Tories right up to the next election. And he needs to be lucky with party discipline, because there isn't much of that either at the moment. It remains to be seen if he has the leadership to do those things. For the sake of my own quality of life, I hope he does. But there's an awful lot of doubt. And Rishi Sunak, if he makes it to the election, well and good. If he gets deposed, there will be a general election, because the Conservative Party is almost torn apart as it is.
Okay, unfortunately, we have to get back into the economy again here, Shabir Rizvi, based on how things are going. But an important stat that I brought up before coming on, and I'm curious as to whether the general public there in the UK even, or the wider world, actually is aware of the fact that more than one in five of the UK population, which is 22%, actually live in poverty. I mean, that's quite a stat, almost a quarter. So if we're looking at that particular stat, all indications are at this point, if this if the UK is going on the track that it is, that that's going to increase. There needs to be something that bridges the UK finances in order to be able to increase people's livelihoods. And that, I'm talking very generally now, so that people don't have to suffer as much, whether it's, as Lembit Opik said, the big three, like mortgages or food or other things, the social services perhaps. The big question is, where is that money going to come from? I mean, he can't tax his way into generating income. That usually doesn't work, if I'm correct to say that. How do you think he should approach it?
Well, there are possibilities of what you're saying, that yes, one in five have huge difficulties, and also we have on a daily basis 5 million people going to the food banks. So there are a whole host of issues as far as economics is concerned. But the reality is that politics impinges on economics, and economics impinges on politics, if you like. There's two sides of the same coin. And if the political situation is not stable, and the Conservative Party carries on in this way, and I was only reading today before coming on to this interview, is that there are some Conservative Party members who are in the Boris brand, if you like, are already sort of jockeying to get rid of Sunak. And it is said that perhaps he might not last until Christmas. So that's perhaps another development that's taking place, and we'll see what happens. But his really big challenge, as our other guest has pointed out, is really the economic issue, and there aren't sort of any silver bullets for him, if you like. Taxing higher, will that generate enough revenue? Or the thought of growing the economy, as the former previous prime minister kept on saying that she wants to grow the economy. How will they grow the economy? Which sectors of the economy would grow? And then, of course, the whole issue of immigration. Do immigrants, new immigrants coming in, contribute to the growth of the economy? Because of the whole sort of problems and challenges and the sort of maligning of immigrants and asylum seekers in the UK, that, again, is not an avenue that is open to the UK to bring in new blood, sure, from foreign countries to grow the economy.
Okay. We only have 30 seconds, Lembit Opik. £2.5 billion so far assistance to Ukraine. UK has announced that it will match it for the year 2023. That's £12 million per day. How could the UK afford that?
It's a political necessity for Rishi Sunak. If he looks like he's not going to be sponsoring Ukraine, he'll be accused of weak leadership. The rights and the wrongs of it, in military terms and political terms, don't matter, except to save his back.
thank you so much. We're going to have to end in there. Lempit Opik there, former member of the British Parliament from London, and also from London, Shibby Risby, political analyst. Thank you to you both. And that is it for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Vitapoy and the team. It's goodbye. Until the next program.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
The real image of the United States of America, or as the journal Economist called the disunited States of America, is seen on the sidewalks of Los Angeles or San Francisco, which are brimmed over with tens of homeless people. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Counterpunch wrote, "One of the six dangerous promises made by Trump should be regain the White House is his plan to deport homeless people from urban centers to tent cities on the periphery. Another word for tent cities is concentration camps. As anyone with a brain can deduce, a Trump team might very well not stop with packing off the homeless to concentration camps. Next could come Black Lives Matter protesters, anyone accused of being Antifa, then all leftists in general, then immigrants. You get the picture. Arranging for forced relocation to tent cities is a slippery slope in fascist hell. Even if it is limited only to the unhoused, it would be an execrable violation of their human rights. So it is to be opposed on all counts. Even more so considering we have available housing for homeless people right now. Just in San Francisco, there are 10 houses sitting empty for every one person sleeping on the street, as San Francisco District 5 Supervisor Dean Preston tweeted on October 13th. We have the housing, but the homeless can't pay for it. Hello? What about nationalizing it? Or less radically, the government could purchase it at a reasonable rate and then give people who need it shelter. But that involves ditching capitalist shibboleths, and the U.S. rulers are extremely rigid about those. It's time to instill some flexibility in elites, not only regarding housing but also with food. Worldwide, plenty of food is produced, enough to feed everyone. It's just that unfortunate economic and political arrangement dispossessed so many billions that many of them can't afford it. As a result, hundreds of millions of people don't get enough calories each day. That's easy to fix. You just have to decide to do it. And that requires not being a blind capitalist ideologue. In the US, Americans have the novel and uniquely widespread phenomenon of homelessness. People who live in their cars. But with the skyrocketing price of gas, thanks to Biden's idiotic Russia sanctions to bolster his Ukraine proxy war infamy, these poor folk may soon have to trade down from their sedan to a sleeping bag on a city sidewalk. If they do that, they will incur the wrath of the affluent, who consider them a blight on neighborhoods that could otherwise support eaters with $10 coffees and $30 sandwiches, or expensive gyms, or any other of the commercial ornaments of the districts of the rich. So, not surprisingly, Trump's plan for 10 cities is widely approved on the political right in the U.S. The homeless are so unsightly, you see. Their misery is supposedly their own fault, because they allegedly use drugs and are often falsely accused of not wanting to work. Rightists skip over the inconvenient fact that many, maybe even most of the people sleeping in their cars do work, like whole armies of adjunct professors, but they get paid so pitifully that they can't afford shelter. Or right-wingers become hysterical about homeless, being mentally ill, well, provide care. That's not complicated, however, it does cost money. But it's easier to scream that vagabonds are not, the implication being dangerous. The equation of mental illness with violence is a pernicious lie, because the most lethal Americans are gun owners, and very few crazy people own guns. They're too busy trying to cope and survive the agony of cohabiting with their internal demons. Whatever the excuse, the wealthy, along with Trump's rapidly fascistic base, which includes many of the nation's police, want the homeless to scram. They want to reclaim U.S. cities are the playgrounds for the rich that they think they were meant to be. Some of the homeless use drugs. Some doubtless sell small quantities of them. A homeless drug dealer? That would be a tougher for the radical right. Vagabond drug dealers, no doubt, would require separate tent camps. They might even get their tent cities blatantly repurposed as death camps. And what starts as an exception for a pariah caste could soon become the norm for the larger group, because when dealing with such a big problem, reactionaries may soon conclude that nothing small will do. After all, there are lots of homeless people in the U.S., officially 500,000, though That statistic is belied by another from the National Center on Family Homelessness, which says 2.5 million children are homeless each year in America. So they have, at a minimum, 3 million unhoused souls in America. Just from casual observation of city life and from the sordid abuse of statistics by American officialdom, is that they have more than 3 million homeless people, maybe millions more. But that's just a hunch based on another manipulated statistic, namely the unemployment one. Since unemployment stats diabolically delete the throng of long-term unemployed people who have given up looking for work, the question naturally arises, how do they live? How do these uncounted jobless, perhaps millions of them, pay rent with no income? Well, they probably don't. There is no charge for sleeping under the stars, and that's about all you can afford it if you are unemployed for years. True. You run the risk of getting beaten up by the police or dying of exposure. And if Trump is re-elected, you could be shipped off to a tent city where the first question to arise is, how will you eat? But if you are one of the droves of unnumbered, invisible people who have been unemployed for years, this miserable calculus is all old hat. After all, food and shelter are luxuries for millions of Americans who have been trained by the rigors of austere capitalism to do without the latter and skimp, to put it mildly, on the former. To Trump and his fellow fascists on the GOP right, homeless people are dangerous and deranged. Yet according to Invisible People, a group that supports the unhoused, homeless people are murdered at a rate 25 times higher than those who have a residence. Indeed, 640 homeless deaths took place in the streets of New York City in 2022 alone. But the homeless are far more likely to be portrayed as perpetrators. That's because they are depicted as a not like us. They are not neat and clean. They don't get to shower every day or sleep in a bed. All these features of vagabondage set off alarm bells on the political right, and they affront the class snobbery of the well-to-do. No fixed address, little bathing. Clearly, these people must be psychotic and threatening. Clearly, they belong out of sight in tent camps. Clearly, respectable people should not be asked to feed them when they are confined in those camps, because clearly they don't have much right to life. They forfeited that when they committed the offense called poverty. The website of Hill wrote, "The typical American experiencing homelessness is often conceived of as a mentally ill individual living in the subways of New York or an addict on the streets of San Francisco or Philadelphia. Those conceptions capture some of the crisis of homelessness, but not all of it. Among the 550,000 to 600,000 people experiencing homelessness in the U.S., are tens of thousands who are not chronically homeless, nor incapacitated due to illness or substance use disorder. These people are capable of work and ready to integrate into the mainstream job market. They're frequently overlooked in the debate on how politicians solve homelessness and also in publicly funded policy solutions." We'll be right back.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.